live in New Jersey?
This is Paul Segers for the National Park Service. We are now beginning tape two of our interview with Manny Steen, who came from Ireland in 1925 when he was 19. Mr. Steen, you've just told us about the voyage over. Let's talk about, now, when did you arrive in New York Harbor? I never asked you what season you left in, what month.
Well, it's funny thing, I arrived in New York Harbor, it was August the 1st, on a Wednesday. It's funny I should remember that the day, I'm not too sure the date, but I think it was August 1st. It was a Wednesday morning. I remember about 6 o'clock in the morning, across the, from the, on board the ship, we were, it says, land ahoy. You know, the lookout had said, land ahoy. Everybody rushed up on deck. We were all, you know, having breakfast or something. We were told that we were having breakfast 6 o'clock in the morning to be assembled in the dining room. And the word came through, land ahoy, from the lookout. And everybody rushed on the prow of the ship, you know, to see land, the first sign of America. I remember we rushing up there looking around, couldn't see a goddamn thing. I mean, the horizon was sea. But what has happened is the earth is round. You follow me? And as you sail into New York, slowly you see New York coming like out of the sea. And the first thing you see, what were these? The Woolworth Building. That was the highest building in the world that time. So the first thing you saw sticking out of the water was the top of the Woolworth Building. And as we proceeded, of course, the building came out of the water, apparently. And everybody, I mean, there were a couple of thousand people.
Was this exciting? How did you feel?
It was exciting. Everybody cheered, America! America, my God, everybody's yelling, crying, kissing, and who can remember? You weren't aware that this was a historical moment. But it was.
Do you remember seeing the Statue of Liberty?
Oh, yes. As we came in, then, of course, Manhattan Island started coming up out of the thing, and we saw this tremendous... Remember, I had never seen anything over, like, a five-story building, my biggest building. And I saw the island coming up out of the ocean, and as we proceeded in, there's the Statue of Liberty. Well, everybody knew what the Statue of Liberty was. I mean, there it was. And it didn't have quite the significance. I didn't understand too much about it. We knew about it, but in very vague terms, very vague terms. I think mostly. They knew a Statue of Liberty, and they really couldn't tell you about it, see. Anyway, here, America, that's what we knew, America.
I want to ask you a little bit about your sister, Bertha. How did she feel about coming to America?
Well, she had been going with some chap, you understand, and had expected to get married. And she was single at the time.
How old was she?
Bertha, I was 19. She must have been 21, 22. And, she's a young girl. She was a... And she had been going with some chap. And my uncle, he said, nothing doing. First of all, he was a different religion. And he didn't think it, that this chap was right for her. And besides, it was a different religion. So you go to America with Manny. You know what I mean? I make a new life there, see? So I didn't know what the hell a new life meant, you know what I mean? I just figured, come over. There was nothing in Ireland behind. I left nothing behind. I didn't have a job. There would look like no prospects. So...
But she was maybe a little...
Yeah, she came here. Went back some years later and married this chap and then came back here again.
I see.
And he eventually died here, see? It wasn't... my uncle was right, by the way. That guy wasn't for her, really. It wasn't, I don't mean because of a different reason, but he was a lazy bum. You know, he lived off where she went out to work. You know, it was, he was that kind of, you know, that kind of a chap. You like this point?
What was Bertha like as a person?
Who?
Very good.
What was Bertha like as
She was not. She became the family mother. She raised the family. She became, when my mother died, she was 12 years old when my mother died. So, and she took over, she left school, and she took over the cooking and the cleaning and everything else. And she...
Did she act like that with you, even?
Oh, yeah, she became the mother. She was the substitute mother, see? And we went to her with, we cut your finger or whatever, you know. She was the mother. And she accepted the role, you know what I mean? And,
very good at it.
Yeah, she was a good person.
I see. Yeah, I was very, just curious. All right, so you've arrived in New York Harbor.
Yes.
Then what happened?
Well, finally, the boat anchored in Mid Bay, Mid Harbor, and then they tendered us from the ship to Ellis Island.
What kind tender, of a vessel?
Like a ferry boat, almost. Like a ferry boat, or similar to a ferry boat. And you took a suitcase, and you by the hundreds, we on the ship, they had to go back and forth a few times, and we landed. Of course, the wharf and the whole area there was not like it is now. It was a wooden wharf, you understand, and gravel walkway, and there was no grass or nothing, no concrete there. The building was grimy, you know what I mean, the outside. There were other buildings. I didn't even look there. When you got off the boat with your bag in your hand, you went right into the building, the main building now.
And there lots of people there?
Oh, must have been that day, must have been about 3-4 ships. Must have been about 5-6,000 people. Jammed. And remember, it was August. Hot as a pistol. And I'm wearing my long johns and a heavy Irish tweed suit. Got my overcoat on my hand. It was beginning of fall back home, see? And I'm carrying my suitcase. I'm dying with the heat. It is terrible hot. I never experienced it. It must have been maybe, I know, 75, 80 degrees. But I never experienced such heat. Besides, I wasn't equipped for it. Anyway, we fortunately, as we got on, it was morning. But during the day, that hall became so hot. And in the hall, all they had was a couple of rotating fans, you know what I mean? Which did nothing except raise the dust, you know, that's all. But there were thousands of people in this building. The place was jammed. And so you're not concerned. You don't realize that this is history in the making. You're just a newbie. You want to get in, get the hell out of there, and get off, you understand?
What exactly happened?
The guards, as we call them there, the customs officers and immigration officials, they first of all, they slammed a tag on you with your name, address, country of origin, etc.
They did that at Ellis?
At Ellis Island, yes. You were tagged. Everybody was tagged. They didn't ask you whether you spoke English or not. Everybody was tagged. They took your papers and they tagged you. That was the first thing. You checked your bag. They had to go through your baggage. And then they pushed you. You know, they just push you. They'd point. Because they didn't know whether you spoke English or not. They could have looked to see I spoke English. But they didn't. Nobody asked me. They had too many, understaffed, overcrowded, jammed. And the place was the noise and the languages and the smell. And it was...
What did it smell like?
Foul, you know what I mean? But I was 19, I could stand a lot then. You'd be surprised what you can take at 19, you know. And it didn't bother me to that extent. I mean, I figured, get out of here fast. You know what I mean? Then there was you had to go through the physical. I think, frankly, the worst memory I have of Ellis Island was the physical. Because the doctors were seated at a long table with a basin full of potassium chloride. And you had to stand in front of them, follow me? And they'd ask you, and you had to reveal yourself. They gave you what we used to, in the army, they call short arm inspection, right there in front of everyone. I mean, it wasn't private. You just had to stand, and the women had to open their blouse. And here, this was terrible. Remember, these were immigrants from a very... reticent people, and here, but nobody was looking or watching anyone. That, looking back, I mean, I can see that. But I was 19, and I was as embarrassed as hell. You know, I had to open my trousers and fly, and they would check you for venereal disease, or hernia, or whatever they were looking for. I don't know when they had the physical, and they would. Although I was a young buck, I was in good shape, you know. But just the same, I felt this was very demeaning, even then. I mean, it's terrible. All the women, young girls, and everyone, you know, all had a line up in front of them. It wasn't personal. It was very, looking back, I think it was impersonalized. But nevertheless, it's a very unpleasant memory. And I didn't, years later, I just thought they didn't have to do it that way. They must have been some other way. But they, remember, this was the height of immigration. They were coming in by the thousands. I mean, the day I was there, I said maybe 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. Who counts, you know what I mean? Place is jammed, you know what I mean? And again, we're not aware that this is historic and this is going to tell your grandchildren about, that I will be talking to you someday about it. I just wanted to get through there and get out. In the meantime, finally, I got through quick and everything
else.
What
else did they do other than the physical? Did, did you have to?
Well, you have customs, immigration. Then you had to show your financial security of $20 and so on. And incidentally, I didn't realize until sometime later. But what happened was a lot of the guys on the ship, you know, I told you they were gambling. Some of the guys lost their $20. Now, but there was a little racket there. You see, there was a wire fence around it, for me, and you had to go through the customs office was there. Now, in order to go through, you had to show your $20. But a little further up on the fence, there was a couple of guys making money. They would loan you, you could borrow $20, cost you $2, follow me? And they would loan you a $20 bill, and you'd go to the gate, and you'd come through the gate, and the guy would be there, take the $20 bill back from you. Cost you $2. For $2, you could show the $20. And now, whether the guy was splitting it with the guard, I didn't know what really was going on. You know, at 19, and I never realized that I was so innocent. You know what I mean? I wasn't aware of what was going on. It was later that I realized, hey, that's a little racket they had there. Well, it wasn't harmful. They got in, you know, so I...
Did you eat while you were at Ellis?
I almost died from thirst. Couldn't find the fountains. Could hardly find the men's room. Now, I didn't know there was a place there you could eat. It's only reading the history books. So there were tables there. They had a piece of bread. But anyway, you were so excited. It was so hot. I was more thirsty.
Finally, did you find something to drink?
No, I never did. What happened was I really didn't think of eating. We had so much to do and get through. Finally, I got through, and my brother, who was supposed to claim me, my claimant, you had to be claimed by a responsible person. My brother was down, and he didn't show up. So I'm waiting. Where they wouldn't let me go on the ferry boat until I was claimed, because he had to come across and claim me.
And Bertha's with you.
Beg your pardon?
Bertha was
with me. Yeah, so I'm talking about both of us, the same situation. So finally, they were closing at 4 o'clock. The island closed at 4. And the staff went home. Anyway, so they shipped me over to the depot on the other side of the island, the ferry building. And I was held there in a group pen for unclaimed, okayed immigrants. Now I went in there, so I was there for about an hour, and they closed at 5.
Was this outside or inside?
This was inside the building. I think they called it the ferry building. I forget.
Were there lots of other people?
Oh yeah, there were other people there. Read on many, because you're concerned about yourself. You know, couldn't be less interested. My brother didn't show up, and here B and I, and we wondered what the hell we're going to do. They're going to send us back. Anyway, we're there about an hour. It was about 5 o'clock, and they said we closed up here. Where's your? I said I don't know. I had no phone or nothing. I didn't know where he lived or what. Anyway. They called up the HIAS, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, who would be responsible, Travelers Aid Society, like. But this was the Hebrew Immigrant HIAS, they call it. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But at that time, they were located, I think, in Lafayette. So they call up HIAS, they turn us over to them to be responsible. Okay, and about 15 minutes later, this little short chap came in, and the funniest thing was, he, knowing that we were Jewish, he insisted upon talking Yiddish. I didn't speak Yiddish, you know what I mean? I spoke English, you know what I mean? A little Gaelic, you know, but no Yiddish. But I did understand German. In college, I had taken a couple of years of German, so more or less got along. He said, "Komm mit," you know what I mean? And he came and he took us both up to Lafayette. Well, first of all, from the ferry building to the subway, which is the other side of City Hall Park, you know, Battery Park, I mean, it's like 3 blocks across. And remember, it is hot. And here I am with my overcoat, my long johns, my suitcase. And geez, and I'm done. And in the meantime, all I had was just a little water. I had nothing to eat. Follow me? I'm getting a little weak. And he's walking. He's in a hurry. He wants to get home. Because this is a chore. He had to bring us up there, see? And he takes us to the subway. Now, I had never seen a subway. We knew that there were such things as subways, underground trains, you know what I mean? But I'd never seen one. And when we come to the, I know if you can imagine the first time seeing a subway train, you come down the steps, the noise, the flashing lights, in those days there was no air conditioning, you know what I mean? And little fans in the train, but It was hot down on the ground. It was, and I sat in, I remember, that's funny how I remember sitting in the subway car with my suitcase, you know, and B was there, and this guy paying no attention to us whatsoever, and I am dripping. And I must have lost 10 pounds a day. And those days, I was only about 130 pounds. And we sat in the front. It was a short ride up to Lafayette. I think it was just one or two stops. And we get off. Oh, God, and they went up in Lafayette up. It was one floor up. Could barely go, climb up the stairs. I was really weak. And we came into this very, it was, by this time it was about 6 o'clock. It was 6:30, something like that.
And this is the highest office.
The highest office, yeah. And this guy said something to the, there was a woman there, and he took off, and she said, "Willst essen?" Well, I, you know, that means, do you want to eat? So I said, yes. So she brought in, I never forget it, because a big bowl of cold soup, I mean, with green things, like a milky substance with some green things floating around it. It turned out to be like spinach soup. It was sour grass soup, they called, a cold soup. Like borscht or something, but it was made from sour. I didn't know, I'd never seen it before, but it was cold, it was wet. And she brought in a big pile of pumpernickel, a pile of butter. And geez, I ate all the pumpernickel. And B and I, we latched in. We really, you should see the pile. I remember back, I mean, like thinking back, what, how did we ever eat all that? See, we were skinny kids, you know.
Can you describe the highest office?
Oh, this was, we were in the, like, dining area, they call it, where they, I guess, accommodate immigrants.
Was this a large building, yeah, or was it a townhouse?
I guess there were offices to the back. We came in, they brought us, like, into the dining room. We sat down. It was long wooden tables. It wasn't anything fancy. We were very plain, very plain. I mean, I was very grateful. She was very nice. The lady just brought it in, you know, and we were so thirsty, and we were hungry with this pumpkin. It was delicious. Fresh pumpernickel with butter, which I still love to this day. Just well, and in the meantime, I didn't know what the hell was his birthday. What do you think it is? She says, I don't know. So meantime, we're pushing the green stuff that was floating around. You know, I was pushing it back because I wanted to get at the liquid. You know, and when we got through, Henry, my brother Henry, comes in the door, and I said, I had seen him, you know, a few years before, so I said, where were you? Boss wouldn't let him off. The boss says, you want to get off, don't come back. So he said, you know, a job is hard. So he says, anyway, I said, how'd you find us? He, Tracy had gone to the island, and they had sent him there, and he backtracked, you know, and he found us. In the meantime, he had taken my sister Eva had been here the year before. So they decided to get a three-room apartment in Harlem, 118th Street. So we moved 118th Street. So we came down. And we went up the subway, I guess. I don't remember how we got up there. Forget now.
What was that apartment like? Could you describe
it? Yeah, it's Harlem. Remember 1925, Harlem was a mixture. It was East Harlem, 118th Street, between 2nd and 3rd, 3rd Avenue. It was a mixture of Italian and Jewish for me, about 50-50. And it was very, very, it was a neighborhood, and a very friendly neighborhood. It was, everybody more or less, you know, knew each other, you know, and the apartment was it's typical three, two-bedroom, I think, apartment we had. And
What floor was it?
I know, it was, do you remember the floor?
First floor.
Cecile lived, I didn't know her. She lived also on 18th Street. She lived on 18th Street and 2nd Avenue. I lived on 18th Street and 3rd, between 3rd and Lex. She was between 1st and 2nd. She knew who I was, but I didn't know her.
Pen pal.
She had given me a phony name, you follow me? But I didn't care. I mean, she was just a girl. I didn't know her. Didn't even know what she looked like. But anyway, we sat there. But in the meantime, my brother Henry said, look, get those long johns off and throw the goddamn things out. They stink like hell. And he loaned me a pair of BBDs. You know what I mean? Oh, boy, it was like getting out of jail. You know, we're getting into those things because the weather was terrible. And we had an ice box. I'd never seen one with a big chunk of ice in there. You know what I mean? That was a tremendous novelty thing. You know, having ice in there, because in Ireland you don't have that. Then, anyway, and so...
Was there a bathroom in this apartment?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, and how? This was the height of luxury, you know what I mean? They had a bathroom and a refrigerator. and a cooker. You know what I mean?
What was your brother Henry doing?
What the hell was he doing at the time?
He was tailoring.
I think he was a tailor, working in tailoring. He worked at any bloody thing.
And was Eva working?
He was doing cabbie. He was a cabbie for a while in New York.
Work.
Huh? Everybody worked.
Eva
was
working also.
Yes, I don't remember what you were working at. Henry, this was a Wednesday, remember, okay? Next morning, Thursday, I got to tell you this. Thursday morning, I'm up bright and early, it's like 7 o'clock, and Henry's up too. And he's getting all, I said, where are you going? He said, I got to go to work. I said, what'll I do? He says, today you take off, tomorrow you get a job. So I said, all right. Now he's the older brother, so he's the boss, you know, and I was accustomed to accepting, you know, this authority, see? He didn't order me around anything else. So I said, what do I do? He says, take a trolley car and go downtown, take a look around. I said, what's a trolley car? He said, tram. That's what they call them over here, trolley cars. I said, all right. He said, remember, if you're going downtown, they go on the wrong side of the street here. You got to go on the right side. So you go from that corner is the way downtown. See? I said, how much it cost? Because in Ireland, England, we have zone system. You follow me? You know, you go from one zone to the next, you pay so much for each zone. He said, no, there's no zone. He said, one fare all the way. I said, that much? He said, a nickel. I said, what's a nickel? You know, I had never seen a nickel. I didn't know what he was talking about. So he puts it in his pocket and he takes out a coin, 5 cent piece. He said, that's a nickel. I said, why did I call it a nickel? He said, figure, I got to go to work. He said, and he took another one. See this one here, that's called a dime. I said, why? He said, look, I'm not going to stand all day here arguing with you. That's 5 cents, this is a dime. Two of those, two nickels make one dime, see? You go downtown, cost you a nickel, follow me? 10 cents will get you back and forth, follow me? He said, but remember, only pay one nickel at a time each way, see? And then he hands me a quarter, a big shot. First, that's the most generous act he ever did in his life. He was a tight bugger. Anyway, this one, that's a quarter. That's a quarter of a dollar, 25 cents. So now I had a 25 cent, 10 cents. He says, that's the money I had, see? He took care of the $20. He was in charge. Well, I accepted this, you know, my older brother, and I don't know. And $20, I want to tell you something. I thought that was untold wealth. And I'd never seen that much money in my life, in my hand, see? So anyway, now I have 25, 10 cents and a nickel. And he said, go down and take a look. So I go to get to the corner. At that time, it was August, remember? And the trolley cars were open trolley cars. I don't know if they still have them, no, they don't have any. They're open trolley cars. They were, and the seats ran lengthways, you know, and you faced sidewalk this way. So, trolley car stopped and I got on, I sat down, and the conductor came, he had a big leather pouch here, and he came over, and the conductors on the Third Avenue Railroad were all Irish, and a lot of immigrants. And he says, where are you going, young fella? And I, at that time, spoke with a brogue. And I says, I'm just taking a ride downtown. He says, is that it here? I said, no. He said, when did you get there? I said, yesterday, I just got off the boat. I mean, it was, you know. He says, why didn't you tell me that? He says, I wouldn't have charged a nickel. You're going to give me a free ride, see? And so he sat down beside me. There was nobody else. It was about 9 or 10 o'clock. And he's pointing, give me a free tour, you know, all the way down Third Avenue. He's pointing at the building, the Singer building, this building. I thought, fascinating. Hey, America's a great place. Look, I'm only here one day. And this guy is, I'm getting a reception, a royal reception. And I was the only guy, and they kept getting on and off the trolley car, and he'd take the nickels and he'd come back. You know what I mean? He was having a great time. And so finally we got off at City Hall Park where it terminated, you know? And he says, come on back, this ride will be on me. We're going up to Van Cortlandt back. I didn't even know what the hell. He said, it's beautiful there. I said, well, no, I'm down here. I want to see, you know, the, well, I'm there. And I saw the City Hall, you know, and walked across the park. And I'm feeling very adventurous, you know what I mean? Here, it's a beautiful day, you know what I mean? And now I hadn't left my jacket off, and I'm just wearing thin underwear, and I'm beginning to feel comfortable now. And I walk across the park, and I'm standing, there's a street going down that way, and I look down, and I look up, and there's the street sign, it says Broadway. Well, I want to tell you, that was one of the most exciting moments of my life. Broadway, I'm only one day in America, I'm on Broadway. I mean, it may sound nothing to you, but I was so excited. It's when I wasn't killed because the traffic was going in all directions. I couldn't figure out. I couldn't figure out which way to try, which way to look first. You know what I mean? I'm so confused watching on the, you know, the left or the right. Anyway, so I started walking down Broadway, and I walked down. I looked down, and I see the Woolworth Building. Now I knew about the Woolworth Building, and I walked down to see this tremendous world edifice. And it was an exciting experience to see that bloody building. And yeah, I stood up and I looked up. And when I looked up, it was a funny thing. The building looked like it was teetering forward. You know what I mean? It appeared to be that way. I guess it wasn't falling. But I had a feeling of hallucination that the building was going to fall down. So I kept going. And down below, I see Battery Park, where the day I had come across from Ellis Island. I said, how do you like that? One day in America, right back here where I started from. And it was an exciting experience, you know.
Yeah, your first day. So
oh,
like...
you don't ask. And I walk across the park, the Battery Park there, and I sit down on the bench, and nobody's bothering me. Nobody is identifying me as a foreigner, you know. Everybody's asking like I was a full-blooded American. And there was a guy with a pushcart. They don't have pushcarts. Well, they do have pushcarts, but not. They were selling food. And this guy was selling hot dogs. Now, I'd known about hot dogs watching the American movies in Dublin. I knew that the people ate this thing here. Honestly, they were sausages. I mean, they don't have hot dogs in Ireland, so they're sausages. So it looked like it was only 5 cents. So I figured I would speculate, you know what I mean? Now, so I asked for a Frankfurter, and he gave me a Frankfurter, and he wanted to put all the stuff on it. No. And the people there were buying, and with the mustard, they were scooping the mustard on it. You know, I was accustomed to English mustard, you know? That's like Coleman's mustard. Did you ever have it? That's enough to burn your guts out, you know what I mean? And I said, how could these people eat with all that mustard on there? So I didn't have anything on it, and I ate it, and it tasted nice. It was garlicky, you know, and hey, that's a nice taste. I never tasted anything like it. And I was sitting there eating my hot dog and taking the world's my oyster. I said, hey, one day in America, I got it made, you know? And as I walked over, I saw there was one guy selling ice cream and nickel sandwiches. They used to sell those days, ice cream sandwiches. I mean, 5 cents. I think I speculated. I really had a ball. I had a hot dog and an ice cream, and I sat down and walked around the building I was in and seeing all the foreigners coming in from Ellis Island. You know, it was a great feeling. Absolutely. I always felt.
Did you feel like an American that
day?
Oh,
I felt, my God, I had the world on a string. I mean, this is my day, see what I mean? And I figured, well, I have to remember now how to get back, you know what I mean? Because I was trying to remember different marks of identification, and so make sure I got in the proper trolley car. And after a little while and so on, I finally got back and got back to Harlem. And I had an exciting day. It was the afternoon I got back, and it was, my brother came home, and he said, I said, an exciting day. I tried to tell him. He thought it was dull and dumb, but it wasn't to me. It was one of my most exciting days. And that was my first day in America.
Wow, yeah. What a great way to start off your life here. When did you get a job?
The next day. The next day, my brother says, got a job. So I said, well, anyway, he was working for American Express. I think he was driving a truck. I don't know what he was doing with them.
This was Henry?
Henry.
I thought he was working as a tailor.
I really am not too sure what he was doing. Maybe he was a tailor then. Whatever that it was. Anyway, he said, try American. Oh, he said, whatever he said. American. So I went down there, and they hired me as an hourly worker, 25 cents an hour.
Was this in that neighborhood?
I had to go downtown. They put me, that time, American Express, American Railway Express, it was called, where they delivered packages. There were packages like Federal Express and so on, but not overnight. They delivered, they picked up and delivery service they had on packages. I got a job on 28th Street in Madison. Sidewalk. They had a sidewalk system of pickup trucks, merchandise. The sidewalk, we would chalk the sidewalk, Hoboken, Pennsylvania Railroad, the different railroads. And as the manufacturers, it was the lampshade district. The shipping clerks would bring the stuff down. I was a tally clerk, and they'd bring the package cartons down. I'd give them a receipt for it, and then I would lay it out according to the depot that it's going to go to. It's going to go to Hoboken.
Tally clerk. Tally,
T-A-L-L-Y. T-A-L-L-Y, tally clerk, right. See? That was my official title. But there was a guy there who showed me what to do and where this goes. And I would pile the stuff up there. And in the afternoon, the trucks would come by from American Express. The Hoboken truck would come and pick up from Hoboken, and he would deliver there. They were all separate trucks for separate destinations. You know what I mean? Railroad depots, mostly, they were taking them to. And then when the truck came, he would give me a receipt for what he would take, you see. The truck drivers, America's Best, were all Irish, too. And they were kidding the shirt off me because I had an Irish accent, a very strong accent at the time. And anyway, I worked there for 25 cents an hour. And within a month, I was getting 40 cents an hour. And I had no ties, so I would work 7 days a week. I worked 60 hours a week. It didn't make any difference. And here, like, I worked 60 hours a week, at 40, and that was $20 a week or some damn thing. I mean, I worked, and I really worked.
Now, did you contribute money?
Oh, yeah. We all chipped in. Oh, absolutely. I turned, like, over everything, just kept what I needed for, you know.
Do you remember how much the rent was on that apartment?
Jesus, you might remember that, you know.
No.
$20, what about $20 probably.
What did Bertha do?
Well, Bertha kept the house. Yeah, she fitted out. And then a little after a while, she got a job, a nothing job. I really don't remember.
So there are what, four people living in the house?
Now we were, yeah, four.
Is Eva's with you all?
Eva, B, Henry, myself. See? Noah was out in the Wild West someplace.
Yes.
My kid brother, Saul, who was here, because he was a little boy, he was young, he was 10 or 11, my aunt had moved, we lived in Montclair. That's the aunt that lived with us in Dublin, not lived with us, but in Dublin. They had gone to America, see? As a matter of fact, they were neighbors of theirs, see? Originally in Harlem, and then they had moved to Montclair, see? So we arranged, because there was nobody really to look at, B got a job, and nobody to look after Saul, and he was a kid, we didn't want to leave him alone, so my aunt agreed that we would all chip in a little bit, and he could live with them.
I see.
And that's what we did.
Describe to us religious life once you came to America.
None of us were, once my mother died and my father died, more or less I'd not participated to any great extent in religion. We came here, right? Again, the same. We were drifting away, not in any religion, we just said we had no interest to us. Mary's folks were pretty orthodox and very religiously oriented. And because my aunt was their next door neighbor, they had a hand laundry. You know what they call a hand laundry in New York is? Well, there are steam laundries, but the hand laundries is where shirts are ironed by hand. And there used to be small hand laundries in New York, wet wash hand laundries and so on. And that's what her father had. Next door to him was dry cleaners. Suits and cleaning and press. That was my aunt and uncle, were the next door, see? And they were friends. But anyway, so I met her family, and they were quite religiously oriented, and they took me in, and met her, and I liked her, and they used to invite me over for dinner. I used to go over there and get a good meal. I always say I married her for her mother's cooking.
Describe what dinner was like. Oh,
her mother was a great cook. Particularly, first it was Friday night. Friday night is a big festive dinner among Jewish people. Chicken, of course. Boiled chicken, soup, you know what I mean? And
Chopped liver.
Oh, yeah. Her mother was a great cook. And I was like about 130 pounds. But I ate like you wouldn't believe it. Unbelievable. I mean, and her mother was like, eat. You know, first you'll eat, then you'll talk, you know. And Mary has two brothers and two sisters. No, a sister and two brothers. And they were so accustomed to this that they were picky and choosy. Where to me, this was the only decent meal I got the whole bloody week, you know what I mean? I would eat there, and her mother would be delighted, you know what I mean? And she'd keep heaping my plate with food, you know what I mean?
My mother was a fabulous
I don't know where I put it, you know what I mean? Because I My eyes were bigger than my son. I used to eat. God, I couldn't eat for 2 days afterwards.
Well, and Bertha was not a good
cook. And Bertha was. And now she has little or no time for it. So while we, I enjoyed very much. Mother, and her mother cooked, while they were people of very modest means, but food was the number one item. Among poor Jewish people, food was the essence of life. You know what I mean?
Not only that, but if you ate strangers, you would bring in to feed.
Anyway,
when did you marry?
1928.
3 years later. That I'm looking back, by the way, and it was it's very interesting to look back. And I said to Mary, you know, in 3 years, look what I had accomplished. It was September 1928, we were married. I was here 3 years. At that time, I didn't realize. But now, looking back, because all I had was the $20 and the clothes on my back. Now, here I am, I'm marrying a lovely young girl, had a big wedding, and now, by this time, I'm set in the business world. Because what had happened was, American Express, I worked for them until the week before Christmas. They laid off all the temporary workers.
In what year?
1925. The week before Christmas, and that's when they come down with tips, you know what I mean, from the factories, you know. The week before, when you get a little extra gravy, we were laid off. Not only myself, all of the temporary, the hourly workers, I was as mad as hell, because first of all, there was a juicy bonuses coming in. Not somebody, you got a dollar tip, you know, from this one, but there was a lot of factories, you know, there. And I was as mad as hell, and I decided. And this is rather interesting. My uncle in Liverpool was manager of the Cunard line, of the office there. And he had given me a letter of introduction to Edison, New York, employment manager. He said he had known him in Ireland, see, or England or whatever. And a little introduction. This will introduce my nephew, Manny Steen, you know, and a good character, etc. So a few days after this, I figured, the hell with American Express. I'll go down, listen. I got this letter of recommendation. I went down to Edison on 1st Avenue, I think it is, 1st or 2nd Avenue, all the way downtown, at the main office. And I had a hell of a job to get the employment manager. Must have had to go to about three secretaries to get in to see him. And by the time I got in to see him, and finally I got in, I had sent a note in advance. And when I came in, oh, it was this beautiful mahogany office. He treated me like a long lost brother. And he said, how's your uncle? And this, and et cetera. And he said, oh, he says, you'll do well here. We're looking for people like you, and so on. I said, hey, do you like that? He's a big man. I mean, this is, look at this. Here I welcome with open arms, like I'm a relative or something. So he said, and he said to me, when can you start? I said, no, I remember it was a Friday. He said, no, take the weekend. Start Monday morning. I said, okay. And he said, well, by the way, you have to fill out the form, you know, application. So this was 1925. So I fill out the application, you know, and I'm sitting there now, oh, I'm glowing. God almighty, I can see, you know, where are we going to now? I mean, there's no end in sight. I gave him the application, and he's reading it through, and he's talking to you. We're having, and all of a sudden, his face fell down here, and he said, "Didn't you make a mistake here, young fellow?" It says religion, and I put down Hebrew. In Ireland, Jews are called Hebrews. See? I said, "Oh no," he says, "Oh, your father or my," I said, "No, my both parents are Hebrews." Oh, he said, "Oh, that's too bad." He says, "You know, I don't make the rules here," he says, "but they don't hire Hebrews." This is 1925. And he takes the application and he's tearing it up. And he all of a sudden, like an area of ice in between, freezing cold. I said, I don't understand. This is my first contact with open anti-Semitism.
Never had it in Ireland.
And I said to him, I didn't understand this. Remember, I was 19. And this... Ireland was a free society. I mean, we recognize our different religions, but that's all. I mean, so you're Jewish or you're Protestant, so what's the difference? There wasn't the bitterness then that there is now in the north of Ireland, for instance.
Well, how did you feel about this?
I felt terrible. Anyway, I said to him, I don't understand. I'm the same guy I was 5 minutes ago. What are you telling me? He said, we don't hire Hebrews. Jews, we call them here. We don't hire them. I said, why? He said, it's a company rule. I don't make the rules. But he said, look, he says, a friend of mine up in Pittsburgh, Westinghouse, employer manager, a friend of mine, I'll give you a note to him. He wanted to get me the hell out of there. And I left there, and I want to tell you, you know how desolated I felt? My God, here, because good things have been happening, and all of a sudden, pow, you know what I mean, this terrible. And I didn't recognize it as anti-Semitism. This was a new experience. And finally, this was like, I told you, on a Friday. So I said, enough. Enough with this crap. I told you I had taken a brush-up course on wireless telegraphy. Okay? I had a certificate, I had a diploma. Now, this is a brand new field. Okay? Monday morning, Saturday morning, the next day, I go down, I look, where's the center? Center was Cortlandt Street, New York. Which the is center of the radio wireless industry. So I went down, how do you get there? When I got down there, I walked down Cortlandt Street, and it was a madhouse. It was Saturday, first of all. The stores were jammed. This novelty radio, at that time you had to build your own set. Now, I had technical training in this, and while I was in wireless telegraphy, my Morse code and so on, but nevertheless, the basic radio, so at that time, was a very simple phenomena, and I understood it. I came down and I looked around, and I said, well, where can I go? Look at one called Walthall, 61 Cortlandt Street. That seemed to be the busiest place. The busiest place, that's the best place to go for a job. I couldn't get in the store. The store was jammed. There were salesmen shoulder to shoulder behind the counter, about 50 salesmen, about 200-300 people jammed in the store. And on the center of the floor was the floor walker. You could hardly see him. And I see this bald-headed guy. I said, hey, I'm looking for a job. So he says, what do you know? I said, I'm a wireless operator. He said, when can you start? This is over the, you know. I said, no. He says, it's too busy. Come Monday morning. So Monday morning, I said, what time? Yeah, 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock Monday morning, I'm down there. And they hired me on the spot. I was the only guy that knew anything about it. These guys were selling it, but they knew nothing, see? So they put me in the parts department where they sold kits. That time, we used to have to build your own radio, what we called breadboard. It was a breadboard set, they were called. And you bought the parts, the condensers and the tuners, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I knew this stuff. It was very simple, really, but they didn't know it. And the owner of the building was a fellow by the name of Nussbaum, Walter Nussbaum. That wasn't the guy I spoke to. But he's an ex-wireless operator. And he and I took to each other like duck to water, because we were both pros, you understand? Commercial operator, and so was he. Anyway, so he put in the parts of mine, because I knew all the parts and everything else, what they were, and I would sell blueprints, you know what I mean, and the parts, and I was getting $18 a week salary, plus commission, PMs we call it. And I would take, Jesus, I'm taking home 20 some odd dollars a week, and the first thing you know, I'm in charge of the department, and the guys that are coming, they were building it, would screw it up, you know, they'd bring it down, and they say, it don't work, and so I'd fix it up for them, and they'd slip me a buck or two, you know, a tip. And I'm taking home $25 a week. My God, I never saw such money in my life. You know what I mean? This, now I got my, now I can see my fortune is here. Within a year, I was assistant manager of the store. The purchasing agent in the store, Phil Masters, he knew nothing about it. And when they would come in to sell him parts, you know, wholesalers, he would call me up for consultation. And I would tell him, oh, no, we couldn't sell that. That's too much, or this or that. What? Anyway, within a year, I was an assistant manager. When I got married in 1928, that's the point I'm leading up to, Nussbaum called me in. And he says, Manny, for your wedding present, I'm going to give you your own store. Gave me a managership. And this was 1920. By that time, I was making $60, $70 a week. But at this point...
Sounds like nothing.
But at this point, I figured another 10 years, I'm going to have enough money, I'm going to go back and I'm going to buy Ireland. And we'll throw all the Irish out. And just Mary and I will live there, I think.
Well, you've certainly had a charmed life in a lot of ways. Isn't it interesting?
I was willing to work without quibble any hours. I would do anything.
Right.
Didn't matter, you understand? He would tell me to pick that up. I'd pick it up. Not my job. I would do it, you understand? And it was eager, bright, and willing, and not stupid, you know. Maybe not brilliant, but not stupid. And anyway, we were off and running. It was fantastic. In the meantime, as I say, I was a manager of the 86th Street on Lexington Avenue. We had a store there. Then I was transferred to Astoria, Long Island. He had great confidence in me, in Nussbaum, because he was opening up stores. And he wound up with like about 20 stores. And there was a little hanky-panky apparently going on in some of the stores. So the result is that he would send me out sort of to clean up the hanky-panky. And it was a wonderful experience. I can share some of the...
It's interesting that a very negative experience that you had on that Saturday morning, or whatever it was, turned to such a positive experience when you went to the radio quiz.
Well, I didn't... I didn't
wouldn't have gone there had you gotten the job.
That's right. I might still be reading gas meters. Yes, who knows? Exactly. For Consolidated Edison Company.
Exactly.
So sometimes, but I didn't say I'm going to turn my life around. It's just that I was very angry. First of all, I didn't understand really what was going on. And unfortunately, it was a lucky stroke of genius that I had taken that crash course. Because now I had an expertise to offer. And it turned out to be, by the way, it was the heyday of radio. You understand? It was absolutely an incredible experience. The people I was meeting, Schickling, DeForest, Dr. DeForest, all of the, they used to come, see, remember, this is the center of radio, and they would come down. I met, what's his name, from Radio Corporation. I can't remember the bloody names there. But so many of, remember, I was a store manager, you know what I mean? And I'm invited to all of the affairs, manufacturer Philco or Fader or these various companies would throw up here, and they'd throw a big party in the Waldorf or someplace. I was a store manager, now I'm an executive. And I was invited to, and met many, many, many of the pioneers in radio.
This is a good point for me to ask a final question, because we only have a couple minutes left. What do you think would have happened if you'd stayed in Ireland?
Well, that's very interesting that you asked that, because what happened, I was here 35 years, when we decided to go to Ireland. I hadn't been back at all. I had more or less kept I had a buddy there, a chap I grew up with, and we had corresponded infrequently, and finally about 1950s, late 1950s, some organization started here in New York, a travel organization. You paid, it was an idea somebody had. You paid in $25 a month a person, and at the end of a year, you got a two-week trip anywhere in Europe. It was like $300 a person, and a two-week trip, all expenses paid. They had their own plane. See, and they went to very exotic places. Oh no, that was before that. I'm talking. Yes.
So you went to Ireland.
Yeah, I went to Ireland, but no, that was before that. I had accumulated. I was working, and I'd accumulated about 6 weeks vacation. So we decided to take a six-week tour of Europe. At that time, a chap by the name of Frommer, F-R-O-M-M-E, or Frommer, had written a little pocket paperback. Europe and $5 a day. You may have heard of it, which if you haven't. So I said, what about that? If we can get a fare, a cheap fare, $5 a day, that's per person, that's with meals. You know what I mean? And you can imagine, well, it must have been 1950 or something, 55. So I took 6 weeks I had, plus two, I took 8 weeks. And I took a map of Europe, and I said, we go here, we go there, and I'll show it to you sometime, really. It's an incredible. For 8 weeks, no reservations. I said, with Frommer's book, it was a self-guided tour. You know, once you had that book, it really was terrific.
And we only have a couple minutes here.
Beg your pardon?
We only have a couple minutes here.
Okay. And what I did want to say was, we flew into London, And from there, I was going to go to Copenhagen while I was in London. Mary says, how about going back to Dublin and meeting Sam and seeing your family? So I called up Sam, and he says, sure, come up.
Sam was your friend.
Sam was my friend. I went to Dublin. We flew, and that's when I saw Sam, who had been a very poor boy like I did when I left, is now living in a beautiful home right behind the Prime Minister's house in Dublin, Rathfarnham, Dublin, and we were his house guests. I said, Sam, where did this come from? He says, Manny, if you had stayed here, you too could have had this. From a poor boy, he now had this. He had a five-story building and two factories, and he had this home and everything. And it was just, I was delighted for his sake. I said, well, I haven't done so bad either, you know. But he had done well. He retired, by the way, to Mallorca. That's where he is now. I spent a holiday with him in Mallorca some years ago.
Oh, it's great. Everybody turned out well.
Yeah, it turned out well, yes, indeed. So,
ultimately, are you glad that Uncle Jack shipped everybody?
Oh, there's no question. Irish economy, even now, the unemployment in Ireland is rampant, absolutely terrible. As you know, the illegal immigrants now by the thousands are coming over here, and they're hiding out in New York and Boston area. The reason for it is because the possibilities of getting someplace are rare. My nephews, I still have my niece living in Dublin. She has five children, three of them are up in Ottawa. You know, because they couldn't make out there. One was a commercial artist in the Irish Times, and he said $30-$35 a week, that's all he could get. He opened up his own advertising agency in Toronto. He's doing fantastic, you know what I mean? And the other chap is a banquet manager. He was a pub manager there, banquet manager for the Holiday Inns of Canada. You know, this kind of thing. It's a wonderful training in Ireland that they got. But this was the... I don't know how I would have done. Sam, I probably would have done all right, I don't know. But what's wrong with what I've done here? I've created my own dynasty, you know?
Well, on that very happy note, I want to thank you very much for one of our most detailed and informative interviews.
I hope you find it of interest.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure I won't be the only one finding it of interest. I suspect this will be an interview that's used over and over again for different purposes.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. This is Paul Segrist signing off for the National Park Service.